talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the history of surrealism and we'll be finding out how it changed the world of art. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Last week, we found out about the people who helped put together the Oxford English Dictionary, talked about women and the anarchy, and also heard about 200 years of pandemic and murder in English history. And if you want to listen back to this or to any of our older shows, just go to the News Talk app, powered by Go Loud, our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. Tonight's show is on the history of surrealism. Surrealism emerged as an artistic and cultural phenomenon in Europe following the First World War, with artists striving to give voice to the unconscious mind. The word surrealism was coined in 1917, but it wasn't until October 1924, 100 years ago, with the publication of the Surrealist Manifesto by the French poet and critic André Breton, that the Surrealist movement formally took shape. Breton sought to blend the realms of dreams and reality into a unified super-reality. The movement spanned various mediums, including painting, literature, theatre, cinema, photography, among others, and has had an enormous impact. And tonight we want to explore the creation and remarkable legacy of surrealism. And so to help explore the history of surrealism, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Felicity G is a senior lecturer in modernism and world cinema at the University of Exeter and has published widely on surrealist literature and film. And she's the author of Magical Realism, World Cinema and the Avant-Garde. Professor Alice Mahon is Professor of Modern and Contemporary Art History and Chair of the Faculty of Architecture and History of Art at the University of Cambridge and is a Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge. An expert on surrealism, her books include Surrealism and the Politics of Eros, 1938 to 1968. Dr. Tara Plunkett lectures in the School of Languages, Cultures and Linguistics at UCD, and her work investigates how Spanish and Latin American artists use the surrealist aesthetic in works of self-fashioning. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll be talking to Dr. Matthew Afron, the Muriel and Philip Berman Curator of Modern Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where an international touring exhibition on surrealism will conclude, and he's the author of numerous books on modern art. Well, you're all very welcome. And Felicity, I might begin with you and just defining surrealism, because it's a phrase that's used all the time when something kind of weird or unusual happens. People say, oh, it was completely surreal. Oh, that was surreal. And it's a phrase that we use a lot, but I wonder, do we use it correctly? And are we using it in the right way in terms of this surrealist movement?
That's a great question. And something that comes up a lot. I would say that the reaction is perhaps faithful to surrealism. So the idea that something has caught you off guard or that something seems incongruous or unexpected is very much linked to some of the original tenets of surrealism. But I think it's really moved past that to become emptied of meaning, in everything becoming surreal, just meaning weird. You know, the films of David Lynch are a good example. The paintings from the Greek, I think, have been a really easy way in for people to think about bowler hats and apples. But actually, to say something is surreal is much more involved, of course.
So what exactly do we mean if we were to go back 100 years then to André Breton and his Surrealist Manifesto? What exactly was being presented as this idea for a movement?
Yes, it's really important to go back to the 1924 manifesto and to think about the fact that surrealism began as a literary movement and actually came out of the idea of automatic writing. And André Breton, who wrote the manifesto, and a circle of fellow artists and writers in Paris were thinking about, I suppose, in the post-war, First World War moment, how to re-engage with the world. And there was the idea to write poems, to write in general, without reason, logic, or morality interfering. So just to untrain the mind. And connected to this are ideas around chance encounters, again, encountering something that's incongruous or unexpected or surprising in the everyday, and using that as a starting point to rethink one's own position in the world.
And how did the art world, and I suppose the wider world, respond then to this? Was it something that was viewed as strange and disturbing, or were people intrigued by what was being presented?
I think there's a mixture of both. And if you look back at historical accounts, there are great examples of, you know, the general public going to film screenings. And part of certainly Salvador Dali and Luis Buñuel's film Un Chien Andalou, which has the famous eye-slitting, eye-slicing segment, were designed to provoke and to shock. And I think a lot of the early exhibitions, when we get into the 1930s and into the 1940s, the general public was still quite shocked and surprised, as is always the case with the avant-garde. It was always designed for everyone. And although we have a collection of reasonably bourgeois men at the helm at the kind of inception of the movement, they really wanted to connect with a wider population to actually make change. And what's interesting, I think, is surrealism's relationship to revolution and actually changing something for the good in society through very surprising methods.
And Alfred Hitchcock, when he was making the movie Spellbound, asked Salvador Dali to contribute a dream sequence.
And
people have talked. So would you consider that a surrealist movie, or a movie that has surrealist sections?
I think it's a very Hollywood version of surrealism. And Dali later went on to work with Walt Disney, of course. And I think what's important here is the popularization of surrealism. And really, the shortcut here in Alfred Hitchcock's film is psychoanalysis and dreams. And so we see the main character go into psychoanalysis with a kind of Freud figure in the film. And the Dali sequence actually depicts his dream. So I think it's a very popularized and an easy kind of way to connect the new technology in cinema, which was very exciting, with the world of dreams and, of course, the dark room of a cinema itself, which is very enticing and very dreamlike.
And what about that Walt Disney collaboration now? Because they, I think, attempted a short film called Destino, but it didn't work, or it certainly wasn't completed at the time, and I think only was completed decades later.
That's right. Yes, and there was an exhibition in, I think it was San Francisco, it was somewhere in America, on Walt Disney and Salvador Dali. I think, yes, there's not a complete version that Dali produced. But it has a lot of the characteristics, elements of his paintings that you would expect, with Greek classicism, with eyes and female figures, very dreamlike. So it's quite an interesting venture for Disney. But if we think about Fantasia, perhaps not so curious to put the two together.
So Tara, what about women and women artists and surrealism then? Who were the most influential ones? And I suppose, how did they engage with this new movement?
I suppose for many of the women artists involved in surrealism, it was quite difficult in the beginning, because if we think about Breton's 98 text, Nadia, that was our first vision of how his desire for women became a conduit through which to tap into the creative subconscious. So from that respect, women had been seen as muses rather than creators of surrealist artworks. But yet, as Felicity has described, when the surrealists gained momentum, particularly when the surrealists arrived in London in 1936, any aspiring artist would be attracted by the vibrancy, by the boundary breaking of surrealism. So people like Leonora Carrington, who are gaining greater traction among scholars were very intrigued by this new movement. And so because of the strictures that had been placed upon them, I suppose they had to find a new way to be simultaneously the artistic subject and also the object.
And tell us about Leonora Carrington then, because you have these dreamlike landscapes, you have symbolic imagery, you have, you know, mythology and the subconscious soul being included in it. What was so different about this? And I suppose it does sound so different and extraordinary. How was it received?
I suppose one of the things that's fascinating about Leonora Carrington is that she was an artist and a writer in equal measure. And this is something that's quite rare, that she's equally known for her vast array of canvases, but also for her short stories and her novels. But she was also extremely well read. So as you've pinpointed, sometimes we have a desire to classify certain forms of reference. She was greatly interested in Irish mythology, but also in Gnosticism, the Kabbalah. And when she moved to Mexico, she became very interested in pre-Columbian history as well. So all of those things combined, much as they do in our imagination.
And is there an element with surrealism where there was a focus on male desire and then therefore women artists had to also negotiate that and try and work around that?
Very much so. And one of the things I talk to my students is the different ways in which various female artists attacked that problem. It may come from more subtle ideas, such as Leonora Carrington. Often when discussing the theme of desire, it might sound a little strange, but she used the motif of the horse in certain paintings to be able to discuss ideas without showing women's bodies in certain ways. And then you also had non-binary and boundary-breaking artists like Cloquin and the Czech surrealist Toyin, who were quite surprisingly much more explicit in their desire, but it wasn't always heteronormative desire.
And it's interesting, Tara, the way you mention your students there. What do your students make of surrealism?
Well, you'd have to ask them, but I think at the beginning they might have, as Felicity had mentioned, quite, I suppose, a stereotypical view of what surrealism is. They may have seen some of René Magritte's paintings. They often have no idea that it started as a movement in writing. But I think by the end of it, they have started to realise that through art, we can really fashion a true image of ourselves. We focus a lot on self-portraits, particularly by women artists, and I think they really start to see that creative expression can really help us to articulate certain ideas and that perhaps the vision of ourselves that we present to the world isn't always as one-dimensional as you might think.
And Alice, you teach surrealism as well. And again, I wonder, how do your students respond to it? And I suppose, are they intrigued by the fact that it has such a remarkable legacy all the way up to the present day in the way it influences contemporary art, in the way that it influenced and had an impact on the counterculture, and the way then that it is a movement that has had a remarkable legacy across many different art forms?
Yes, I think at Cambridge we find students probably do have a certain nostalgic image of surrealism, or they associate it, as you've said, with René Magritte or Salvador Dalí. But they find I think surrealism has become so much a part of visual culture today in terms of film, in terms of advertising, in terms of design, that there's a sort of, there's an excitement to dig deeper into it. And certainly, I do teach sort of from the 1920s through to the 60s and feminist and Afro-surrealist art today. And I think students realize that because they're sort of surrounded by it on television in terms of shop display, in terms of actually the sort of fact that on the news, they say, oh, that's so surreal, often even on sort of media, 9/11 was described as surreal, that they want to learn a bit more about it. And in the 60s, for sure, there's a sense that surrealism evolved across decades from being very literary in the 20s to increasingly exploring sculpture, objects, exhibition practice in the 30s and 40s. And by the 60s, you do have artists who began in surrealism moving into happenings, into the events of May 68, into more countercultural practice. And I think that's where the seed, or where you have women artists who were involved in surrealism from the 30s on, sort of becoming really inspirational for feminist artists of the 70s, that first wave of feminists who were going, hang on, there's a really exciting group of modern women involved in surrealism, and women who often don't want to sort of declare themselves as feminists, but are putting sexuality center stage of their art. And that really paves the way for women artists like Carolee Schneemann, for example, Kusama too, trying to think about installation, about using their own body, about eroticism. And I think it's just by then there were several decades of a whole portfolio of ideas and philosophical ideas in the mix that excited the 60s generation when, you know, the personal became so fabulously political.
And you curated the first major retrospective of the American surrealist Dorothea Tanning. And I think that was in a museum in Madrid and then for the Tate in London. And talk to me about her significance and her influence.
Yeah, well, Dorothea Tanning, so that was 2018-19 for Reina Sofía and Tate Modern. So she was a woman, she's a really good example of the modern woman who was attracted to surrealism, because she, you know, she was born in Galesburg, Illinois, tiny sort of, you know, one horse town. And she traveled to Chicago, New York. There she discovered surrealism in 1936 at the Museum of Modern Art's now infamous exhibition, Fantastic Art, Dada, Surrealism, which again brought Disney together with Dada and surrealism. So from that stage, they were kind of realizing that surrealism was not containable. It wasn't just within an exhibition space. And she said it rocked her over her heels. That was her expression. And she found women artists in the mix there, which was also exciting. But she's a good example because then she traveled to Paris. Then she went to Sedona, Arizona, back to Paris, France, the south of France, New York. So she's kind of got a nomadic, definitely a sort of brave existence as somebody who was married to Max Ernst, was exhibiting with the predominantly male sort of surrealist group from the get-go, but then increasingly, as I say, sort of expanded the boundaries of surrealism, because André Breton died in 1966. Surrealism in 1968 said that it had moved onto the streets and was no longer a movement, but she had her first show in the 1970s in what is now the Pompidou in Paris, where they realized surrealism had sort of exploded even further in a kind of new women art direction. So she's an example of someone who decade after decade did different things with surrealism. My challenge as a curator was to bring works which were scattered to the far ends of the world, frankly. There was only so many in major museum collections, a lot in private. And she'd done a lot of soft sculptures, which hadn't been documented extensively. So some of the work is recuperating, is documenting for the first time, but it's more so trying to show that surrealism was much messier, had many more artists, was more global, and that women were always sort of center stage. But most male and female surrealists just defied the idea that they would be defined by their gender. You weren't to be a male artist or a female artist, because surrealism was a worldview, a philosophical perspective. It was something that went beyond that and was very political. So the politics of feminism and gender were part of it, but they were much more anti-colonial, against war, against the Algerian War, World War, Vietnam War. So they were very active in statements, interviews, as well as in their art practice.
And Alice, you were also the curatorial advisor for the first retrospective exhibition of Leonor Finney, who is Argentinian, Italian, and a very significant surrealist artist, and someone who did some very striking paintings, bold, provocative paintings, but then also famous for her unconventional lifestyle.
True, and I think that's part of it. They were, when we define them as modern women, it's not just they were in the 20th century, they were refusing to, you know, do what was expected. They weren't just going to go to college to find a husband. If they did go to college, they didn't train as painters. They wanted to come up with new modern ways of living. So they rejected the idea that family society expected them to be wives and mothers. They majority, including Finney, Tanning, they did not have any formal training as artists, but very few surrealists did. And what they did was they turned to art. They actually looked back at academic art and then advanced it in new surrealist directions involving the subconscious, involving ideas around desire. If they addressed maternity, it would be more about the fact that they were interested in creativity rather than procreativity. And Finney was, it's true, I think sometimes the image, there's a want, and that was the publicity around these artists in the 30s and 40s, was to make them sort of living examples of surrealism. Again, a bit comparable to Salvador Dali being an eccentric. And that's how the press very much advanced their image. Or, you know, they won a lot of photography and press attention because they dressed exotically. Finney herself was very interested in costume, masks, and a masquerade ball. So she would be photographed alongside Brigitte Bardot in the 60s and 70s, for example, as somebody who was living surrealism. But she was still somebody who, having been born in Argentina, reared in Italy, and her professional career was very much in France. She's still very much somebody who, as I say, who exhibited. She was exhibiting the first surrealist exhibitions in the 30s. She was working in the 40s, and she continued to work across media, which is something else that's worth sort of thinking about surrealism. So most surrealists work in text and image. So they write fiction, and they're producing paintings, prints. They work with theater, ballet. Fini worked with ballet. She worked with Jean Genet and productions of his The Maids, for example. So she was part of a very avant-garde, what we now call sort of quite countercultural, but a really diverse group. She also worked with Fellini, the filmmaker. So because they were sort of tapping into so many different fields of culture, I think often in the public imagination, people might only associate them with one or two paintings. But in digging deep, researching or curating exhibitions, we find they were fabulously productive. And in her case, she did live with two men, many cats. So again, she held salons. She was really encouraging of younger artists and writers. And she just said sort of the role of mother and wife wasn't for her. And of course, it wouldn't have allowed her the freedom, literally, to pursue her artistic ambitions.
Felicity, there is an international society for the study of surrealism, and I think you're currently the vice president of it. And I just wanted to ask you about surrealism in that international context. Was surrealism the same in Britain as it was in the United States, as it was in mainland Europe, as it was in South America?
No, it wasn't. But what's really interesting is that in the 1930s, for example, the fields of ethnology and ethnography were starting to come up. And obviously with the catastrophic upheavals of war, where people were exiled and thrown from their place of belonging, people travelled a lot. And the surrealists are a mix of people who were forced into exile and people like Breton who chose to travel more broadly. So I think, you know, going back to the idea of what students think about surrealism, it's very much defined in European terms. And what's really interesting is to think about Cuba, Haiti, Martinique, Canada, Australia, Egypt, and the various movements and people. So, you know, Czech surrealism is really prevalent and is one of few surviving surrealists groups. The Prague Surrealist, the filmmaker Jan Švankmajer, worked with Breton in the 1960s, for example, the early 1960s, and prior to that as well, and continues to inspire largely with animation. And I think what's really interesting about surrealism being mobile and international, use the modern word international, but global or world kind of encompassing, is that it takes on aspects of local and regional cultures. And that, from a political point of view, it becomes very useful, but also in terms of folk cultures and spiritual belief systems in different cultures. So on the one hand, it is very different and distinct, but it is also very sort of respectful and in dialogue with those original texts and later texts from the French surrealists and from Europe. So one of the things that is important to talk about with students is the question of exoticism and, you know, Breton going to Mexico and Antonin Artaud, the theatre director, going to Mexico and saying, you know, this is this amazing, wonderful country. And when you read those documents in a present day context, they seem very exoticist, you know, very much from a European centric point of view. And it's useful to unpick that and think about actually how important surrealist methods and forms of expression and art were to people in non-European, non-American countries. And that even though we can think about how there is an exoticism, as Alice said, the surrealists were very vehemently anti-colonial am very, very interested in other cultures, other peoples, and abolishing, you know, it's a utopian aim, I suppose, of surrealism to abolish hierarchies. And this is part of that spirit of collaboration and communication across the world.
And Tara, it is very interesting the way surrealism did spread around the world. And we heard there about it arriving in Mexico, and the way it did travel to places like Spain and Mexico is a really interesting part of the story and the impact it did have.
Yeah, and just picking up on what Felicity was saying there about when surrealism travelled across the world, obviously the group of European emigres who arrived in Mexico around about 1942 had just suffered tremendous trauma. Many of them came from different directions. And it's interesting to consider that obviously when they arrived, they tended to maintain themselves among their own circle, but there was already a very thriving scene in Mexico City, particularly a nationalist muralist movement that was very much fueled by a sense of pride in Mexican identity and indigenous identities. So I think those two communities, they coexisted, but we still don't know to what extent they coexisted peacefully. I mean, nothing is black and white. You know, Leonora Carrington was very much a guest at Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera's home at the same time. They were pushing what it seemed to be quite different ideals. Having said that, the group of artists and intellectuals that arrived in Mexico are still very much remembered as part of Mexican cultural hegemony. Leonora Carrington and Remedios Varo in particular are very much seen as Mexican as well as they were European. So I think it's very, very complex. And that kind of tension hasn't really been explored to a great extent and would be really interesting to explore.
And was there a tension between the different forms of art at that time? You had cubism and expressionism and dadaism. Were they quite distinctly one type, or could a piece of art actually have influences from a few of them?
100%. I start off my course on surrealism in Spain and Mexico introducing students to paintings by Dalí, as I think that's one of the most accessible ways for them to see this. And in Dalí's early works, particularly in the mid-1920s, you can certainly see that one painting could simultaneously be described as cubist and a surrealist. Because as you know, with many young artists, you will dabble in various different forms of expression before finding your own way of expressing yourself through surrealism. So he began by experimenting and then eventually came up with his own aesthetic ideas about what surrealism should be. So I think you'll see that in many, many different examples.
I sometimes think that if I was going back to college to study something, I would do the history of art, because I do find all of this stuff fascinating. But I also think I'd be rubbish at it, because I think this would confuse me completely.
So many of my students are terrified the first time I ask them to analyse a painting. But I think all we have to do is think about, we're so used to analysing a film or reading a short story. And I suppose if we employ the same tactics when it comes to taking apart a piece of art in whatever its form, we'll be surprised at what we can see. And also surrealism is fascinating for that, because as Alice had mentioned, artists were producing works in various different media. So often you'll find a rumination on the same idea, but in image, text, sculpture, theatre. And I think one can help us to read the other, so to speak.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the history of surrealism. And we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Dr. Matthew Afron, the Muriel and Philip Berman Creator of Modern Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where an international touring exhibition on surrealism will conclude. It's called Imagine 100 Years of International Surrealism, and we'll be finding out all about it right after this. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we're marking the centenary of surrealism with our expert debate on the subject. And I'm delighted to be joined now by Dr. Matthew Afron, the Muriel and Philip Berman Creator of Modern Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where the international touring exhibition on surrealism will conclude. And he's the author of numerous books on modern art. Matthew, you're very welcome to the show.
Hello, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So can we talk about this touring exhibition? It's called Imagine 100 Years of International Surrealism, and it's been travelling around the world, and in each new place, in each new city, in each new museum, there's a new twist on it. There's a new variation of it.
That's correct. The exhibition has launched in Brussels in its first version, or its first iteration, but it will be different in every one of the partner institutions. And that means that there will be a different version of surrealism or a different take in each place. And each museum is and this is what I think is interesting about this, is going to present a story of surrealism that is relevant to its own location and its own history, its own collections.
So what about Philadelphia there? Because it's concluding there at your Museum of Art. What will be the American dimension to it, or the Philadelphia dimension?
That was easy, actually, because we have a strong story to tell, again, based on our own history. In other words, the history of our collecting of surrealism at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and also our presentation of surrealist exhibitions, which goes way back. The angle we're taking is to focus at a certain point in the chronology of the show. That means at the point when you get to the cusp of World War II, we're focusing on how it is that a very important cohort of surrealists came to North America as exiles, how the experience of coming to both Mexico and the United States in that period affected them, and how surrealism affected the work of younger Mexican and U.S. artists who encountered them.
And how was surrealism, how was it received in the United States? Because you have that fracture between surrealism and symbolism. You have the subconscious and the imagery and the iconography. It's all, it seems quite challenging and quite different than I'm curious to see how people viewed it and received it in the 1920s.
I would say that in America, surrealism was received as a great opportunity to expand the kinds of ideas and also the techniques, the ways of picturing the world or of picturing your imagination. And there was a fertile ground in the U.S. for new ideas among younger artists like Jackson Pollock, like Mark Rothko, and like Dorothea Tanning, and many others.
And in terms of what you're trying to show with the Imagine show, how are you connecting with, say, for example, surrealism in Europe, surrealism in South America, and the way the surrealism story seems to have been, or surrealism seems to have been kind of reinvented in every different region and part of the world?
Well, that is a vast topic, and something which we can only do in a sort of focused way to evoke the bigness of what you just mentioned. But essentially, there is a core list of works by surrealists working in France, but who were not all French, and surrealists working in other parts of Europe and in the U.S. And that forms a kind of spine. And then in each venue, we're fleshing out aspects of the big global story that you just mentioned in our own different ways. So that basically you would have to put all the shows together, if you could, in a kind of imaginary exhibition to see the extent of what all these different partner institutions are accomplishing.
So American surrealism isn't perhaps as widely recognized as its European counterpart. So maybe tell me about some of the great American surrealists, Max Ernst, K.A. Sage, you know, some of the great American artists, Dorothea Tanning.
Well, so it's interesting. You just referred to Max Ernst, who, of course, was born in Europe and was active in Paris from the very beginning of the Surrealist movement, and then was one of the exiles who came around 1939, 1940 to the States for a period of time. Ernst is one of the great inventors of radical new techniques. Techniques such as collage, decalcomania, which is a kind of method of smashing the paint medium on your canvas and then pulling away a surface in order to reveal new textures that can spark new visual ideas. So he was one of those Europeans who really catalyzed the surrealist method in the U.S. when he arrived. Whereas Dorothea Tanning is an American artist, so is Kay Sage. They're coming from the other geographical pole, let's say, but encountering this always international group of surrealists and recognizing kindred spirits, and then taking some of the key ideas of painting dreamlike spaces rather than real spaces, or painting psychological states through symbolic objects These ideas already existed, but then they were, of course, sent into directions by people like Sage and Tanning.
And in Europe, there was very often a connection between the surrealists and left-wing politics and either anarchism or communism or even Trotskyism and so on. In the United States then, when you had the Depression and you had, you know, the crisis of the 1930s and you had the New Deal, do you see with the surrealists a critique of capitalism? Do you see them engaging with some of those great debates and issues of the time?
You see them picking up on the great surrealist doctrine of independence of thinking, independence of mind, and desire to find a way to be critical of this of the status quo in the largest terms. And so, very often, what you find not so much in American surrealism a direct and specific commentary on current events or current politics, but you see a desire to get past the ordinariness of our concerns, of our day-to-day concerns, and attack the biggest themes of human experience in ways that tend to, again, transcend the specificity of the social scene around them. And that's one of the ways in which the surrealists in America were different from other painters active in the U.S. in the 30s and 40s who were more involved in direct commentary on the social scene.
So we've mentioned some who were born in Europe and then came to the United States. What about someone like Man Ray, who was born in the United States but then spent most of his career in Paris? And what about his contribution to European surrealism as this pioneering photographer and someone who's involved with painting and film as well and who seems to have been hugely influential?
Well, his story is one of the ones that you will encounter in various versions of the show, and certainly the Philadelphia version of the show. And he's very interesting for the reason you just said, a kind of exemplary cosmopolitan international figure. Right? He starts his career as a modern artist in and around New York, then as a painter, then goes to Paris and picks up a camera. This is a simplified chronology, but more or less the story. And immediately is recognized as someone who is doing absolutely creative things with photographic techniques, such as his famous rheograms, which are cameraless photographs, which seem to record tangible things, but to empty out their tangibility, making them into ghosts, making them into spirits, making objects into something which is more mental than physical. So he's innovating in photographic techniques, and he becomes a really key member of the Surrealist group because he's able to create such strong images that they then publish in their magazines and exhibit in various places. But he's also a painter, and then he leaves around the time of the Second World War and continues that life across the two sides of the Atlantic.
And what about those who were critical of surrealism? I'm thinking of the essayist Clement Greenberg and people like that, who perhaps saw it as being too elitist, or there were others who thought that it didn't align with American cultural values or that it was problematic in some ways. That there do seem to have been those who were hostile towards it.
I think that is a permanent condition of a art movement, really a movement in culture and in thought, which wants to rethink everything. You're going to make a lot of enemies because you're taking a very strong position on where are we today and where are we going. And so there were people in the U.S. who attacked surrealism from all sorts of positions, conservative positions or more radical positions. Also, of course, surrealism is an extraordinarily long-lived movement in culture and in the visual arts and in poetry and so forth. So it goes through generations, and every generation it was attacked and rethought itself. And so, you know, by the time you get to the 40s and the 50s, Clement Greenberg, a prominent critic in the U.S., he has the feeling that it has really had its life and that there are new things coming. And so he was critical of surrealism for that reason. But then, of course, every time it is pronounced to be over with, it seems to come back to new life with new people. And so that's a kind of constant story.
Do you think that we're living in the world the Surrealists made, given how they had such an enormous influence on cinema and literature and on art and really just on the world around it, even though we might not think that they did?
I agree with you. I think that we are now, and we have probably been since the 1940s and 50s, living in a Surrealist world, because Surrealism is so pervasive that it's really in the water, so to speak. It's in Hollywood cinema. It's in advertising photography. It's in the everyday world of images that surrounds us all the time, and it is constantly returning in that arena, even as it also returns in various forms in the kind of art that you see in galleries and museums, but made by younger and even living artists. So yes, I think we are living in a Surrealist world, and that's proof of its vitality, even as, of course, all the figures who were there from the start are long gone.
So what are the dates for the touring exhibition in Philadelphia?
The exhibition in Philadelphia will begin around the beginning of December of next year, 2025, and then into February of 2026. And as you said at the top, it is the final leg of this long international tour, and also the only U.S. venue for the Surrealism Project.
So, and if our listeners want to catch it before then they can just go online and they can see where it is around the world. It's going Paris, and it's in Germany, and it's Madrid, and it definitely is doing this wonderful route around the world. And why do you think Surrealism matters? Why should we mark this centenary?
I think it matters because it really stands for some of the great ideas in 20th century art and culture, some of the greatest inventions of new techniques, like the Man Ray's rarograms or the collages of Max Ernst that I referred to earlier, on the one hand, and also the spirit of Surrealism, which seems just totally undying in the modern world. And that spirit is about, again, independence of mind and a desire to find something really magical in a life which doesn't always have that.
Well, my thanks to Dr. Matthew Afron, the Muriel and Philip Berman Creator of Modern Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, for joining me tonight to talk about that international travelling exhibition on Surrealism and also Surrealism and the United States. Matthew, thanks so much.
Pleasure to speak to you.
We'll be back with our expert panel after this break, where we'll be continuing our exploration and debate on the impact and legacy of Surrealism. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and we are talking about Surrealism as this year marks the centenary of the founding of the movement. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Felicity G, who's Senior Lecturer in Modernism and World Cinema at the University of Exeter, and who has published widely on Surrealist film and literature. Professor Alice Mann, who's Professor of Modern and Contemporary Art History and Chair of the Faculty of Architecture and History of Art at the University of Cambridge, as well as being a Fellow of Trinity College Cambridge, who's also an expert on Surrealism. And Dr. Tara Plunkett, who lectures in the School of Languages, Cultures and Linguistics at UCD, whose work investigates how Spanish and Latin American artists use the Surrealist aesthetic. And Alice, maybe we might talk about Surrealism and politics, because I've read that Surrealism is connected with Trotskyism, communism, sometimes even anarchy and anarchism. Is there a political component to it as well?
Yes, I think from the get-go, Surrealism, it launched itself with the Manifesto in 1924, which is a political statement declaration in the first place. So it was critical as a movement in always issuing tracts, manifestos, so collaboratively signed documents. And they usually dialogued with not just its aesthetic position, but with aspects of psychoanalysis and politics too. So I think so there was a declaration or a manifesto in 1938 between Diego Rivera in Mexico and Trotsky, who was exiled there, and André Breton again when he visited. So that's where those triumvirate came together to issue a tract calling for independent art, and it was Trotskyite in ambition, as opposed to, you know, against Stalin, who would have marshaled art into totalitarian social realism. So the Surrealists were always emphatic that they were political, but they would not be put to political use in the sense of their of being confined to a very particular style or agenda. And so I think that's what often not, you know, people sort of struggle a little bit with that idea that they were so utopian about the idea of freedom and freedom for all. You can't, you know, police people's unconscious minds and desires and fears, but always they were dialoguing with what was actually going on the street. So they were born out of war. They were against World War II. They were against fascism and making statements about fascism in the 1930s. They were supporting and exhibiting artists who were on, you know, the Gestapo hit list effectively. And one of the reasons they all had to flee, as has been mentioned, is because, again, they were perceived as avant-garde, as pro-communist, and supporting also artists who identified as lesbian or gay at the time. So I think, in essence, they're Trotskyites, that Trotsky never believed that you had to that you should be, there should be an element of freedom for style, whereas Stalin wanted a social realist style, which is legible. And that politics persisted in that post-World War II, they sort of pursued mythology, the sacred. They looked to Indo-American art, oceanic art, to try and find other forms of spiritual healing. And again, because they really believed in art having a having a role, a responsibility to enlighten us, to make us think differently as individuals. And so I think that's where the activism and its sort of utopian dimension lies, is that they believed art has this power to change society. It shouldn't just be confined to the walls of a gallery. But their logic was that it had expanded into the streets to such an extent that the historical movement was over in all the best ways, because it was no longer containable.
And Alice, what you're saying explodes that idea that surrealism went into decline in the 1930s. And from what you're saying, that clearly isn't the case. But yet there were significant challenges in the 1930s. And it does seem to have dipped in terms of its popularity. And it also seems to have been a movement beset by a lot of personal divisions and problems.
Well, I think it depends, because if you read biographies and, you know, the biographies of many surrealists are artworks themselves. So you need a sort of a bucket of salt, not a pinch when you're reading them, to be honest. But by the 30s, the main thing was it was a cultural war. So yes, in terms of the French nation, and when they did a world fair in the end of the 30s, they weren't going to include the surrealists because they were just too hot to deal with. They were too political. They were spouting communist and Freudian ideas. And Freud, again, as somebody who was a Jewish psychoanalysis banished to London by the 1938, was again just, you know, too hot to handle. So I think there was the element of them being, in the true sense of avant-garde, just being difficult for national politics. But then when it came to the moment of exile, historians like to say they died as a movement with World War II, but that's also because New York, quote unquote, sort of stole modern art from Paris. So there's a sense that the American art scene wanted to launch and emphasize Jackson Pollock, abstract expressionism, and that to continue to represent the body, the fragmented body, the erotic body after the Holocaust, after the horrors of World War II, was seen to be, again, really too contentious, sensationalist. In terms of the 1930s, where surrealism was actually being vocal, politically anti-fascist at a time when most of Europe were trying to pretend that Hitler was not gaining power and stealth, right through to 1937, the World Exhibition in Paris, where surrealism was sidelined because it was too contentious politically, because it was addressing fascism. It was incorporating artists who were emphatically anti-fascist, who had fled Berlin. And surrealism had been denounced already by Hitler's regime. So for any sort of public exhibition to support surrealism would have been to take on that burgeoning sort of sense of fascism. But I think a lot of the sort of mythology, really, rather than history around surrealism, is to say it died with World War II, with the moment of exile, whereas, in fact, for most of us working on surrealism, that's where we argue it became uncontainable because it expanded globally and it found other artists who'd already been thinking through surrealism and who were also in exile. So New York became a melting pot of global artists, much as Paris had in the 20s.
Tara, I find André Breton a fascinating figure, and all of his remarkable texts on surrealism and that contribution to surrealist literature. But some of his ideas seem a little bit strange as well, as belief in chance and randomness and against logic and rationality, that it was a very interesting approach to how he wanted these things to be done.
I suppose there was always this perennial attempt, and this might sound a little strange, but to find the place in the mind where reality and the dream cease to be in opposition. And it speaks to the avant-garde desire to reintegrate art into life. Or if an artist can make you question your own reality for one second, well, then perhaps you might rethink, and in the case of surrealism, the bourgeois norms that had led them from one world war into another. Many people take issue with the fact that Breton, as a heterosexual man, quite often channeled his desire for women as a way for him to access his creative subconscious and figure out who he was, which we see in Nadia, where his chance encounter with a young woman, despite her having very obvious mental health difficulties, he used as a way to try to tap into his creative subconscious. So despite the book being titled with her name, the first line is, "Who am I?" I do think Breton evolved, particularly as regards his view of women and their creative potential, not just as muses, but as artists in their own right. However, we always have to look at these figures through the lens of history at the time. So he's slightly redeemed in my eyes by the time he wrote the book Arcane 17. But we're still having to look at this through the lens of the society that he was in.
Felicity, did surrealist literature have the same impact as surrealist artworks and paintings? Because someone like Leonora Carrington was hugely successful. But if you look at The Hearing Trumpet, it's a Penguin modern classic. It's described as the occult twin to Alice in Wonderland. But yet it doesn't have anywhere near that same maybe readership as Alice in Wonderland.
No, it doesn't. I think the history, the publication history of Leonora Carrington's work, certainly in the UK, is really interesting because I think writers like Angela Carter actually made Leonora Carrington's work seem much more avant-garde and ahead of its time. It's very irreverent and funny as well, surprisingly funny.
And Felicity, David Lynch has been mentioned, and I wonder, when you look at his TV series Twin Peaks, that was often described as surrealist because of its dream sequences and the aesthetic and the use of symbolism and metaphor in it and absurdity and dark humour. Would you consider that a surrealist series?
It's interesting, and Michael Richardson has written about this in his book Surrealism and Cinema, where you have film directors who are surrealists, and then a surrealist attitude. David Lynch clearly, when he's interviewed, refers back to surrealism. And one of the cautions, I suppose, is we need to delineate between something like absurdism, which has its own history, or existentialism, and surrealism, which are very different. So I think it's easy to kind of dismiss David Lynch as a kind of Hollywood popular filmmaker that's just taking on those, as we said at the start of the conversation, those kind of vernacular popular ideas. But actually, I think there's a lot to his work.
And Alice, do you think that, you know, a lot of people listening may not have realised that this year marks the centenary of surrealism? They may not know much about surrealism, although hopefully after this discussion they do. But it's a movement that, in a way, you could say we're celebrating its triumph because it has reshaped the world over the past 100 years.
I would. And I would say it's you know, high and low culture. It's in art. It's in museums. People go to see it. So now they might, you know, rethink it. It's, as I say, it's in sort of fashion. It's used for advertising. It's used for jokes. It's used for lots and lots of things. But I think also the 100 years isn't to sort of commemorate it as something that is past and done. All of us teaching and working in surrealism are very much saying it's the idea that there is still much to be done, if you like. So we're not trying to commemorate it, but note what was important about it, and again show how it breathes on in many various forms, and how there was much more to it still to be discovered, and that it's been quoted because from that first manifesto, it believed in the fragility of life, the need to protect life, and it called for freedom as the one thing that we must continue to fight for.
And I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion of surrealism tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Felicity G of the University of Exeter, Professor Alice Mann of the University of Cambridge, Dr. Tara Plunkett of UCD, and we also heard from Dr. Matthew Afron of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, to Steve Daunt and Hannah Flam on research, and to Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.